It's Tuesday, the 30th of September, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, in Flagstaff. Today, from the front page of the Wall Street Journal, we have these headlines. Trump outlines plan to end Gaza war, threatens Hamas. Boeing launches work on 737 MAX successor. And OpenAI video to test copyright guardrails. Turning to that first headline, Trump outlines plan to end Gaza war, threatens Hamas. President offers 20 points, tells militants to accept in 72 hours or face annihilation. This is by Anat Peled, Summer Saeed, and Alexander Ward, Washington. President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel agreed to a 20-point plan to end the war in Gaza, and Trump told Hamas it had 72 hours to accept the deal or suffer complete annihilation. If Hamas doesn't accept or the plan falls apart, Israel would have my full backing to finish the job of destroying the threat of Hamas, Trump said, as he stood next to Netanyahu at the White House. For months, President Trump warned Hamas that it had to release all remaining hostages or face Israel's wrath. But on Monday, he essentially threatened the prospect of more war to end nearly 2 years of fighting. The move ranks among the riskiest diplomatic gambles for Trump, which he delivered next to Netanyahu to show that at least one warring party agreed to his vision to end the war. If Hamas doesn't support the proposal, then the U.S. would back Israel as it targeted the U.S. designated terrorist group in its last remaining strongholds. Israel will finish the job by itself, Netanyahu said during a joint statement following the White House meeting. This can be done the easy way or it can be done the hard way, but it has to be done. Trump's plan, if adopted, would see the president chair a board of peace to oversee the interim governance of Gaza. Aid would flow into the enclave and an Arab-led stabilization force would swiftly keep order. Israeli forces would, over time, withdraw from the battlefield while maintaining a security buffer zone around Gaza. Hamas would lay down its arms while forever renouncing its leadership role. In response to the Trump plan, the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the UAE, Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt said they supported the U.S. efforts and called for full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, as well as for the enclave's reconstruction. They said they would work with the U.S. to end the war and called for the renewal of peace negotiations that would lead to a Palestinian state. Israel helped shape the Trump plan, officials said, and pushed for several amendments that appeared in the final draft. Most notably, the proposal leaves open the possibility of a sovereign Palestine state, but doesn't include the phrase two-state solution. It instead noted the aspiration of the Palestinian people for self-determination. To its credit, this plan tries to bridge some of the gaps that have plagued diplomacy to date, said Michael Singh, who was a top Middle Eastern official in George W. Bush's White House and is now at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The proposal further adds diplomatic pressure to the military pressure Hamas is facing and brings non-Hamas Gazans into the discussion, he said, though it may not end the fighting or gain immediate purchase. If Hamas doesn't sign on to these conditions, then the U.S. and Israel, plus Arab and international partners, would realize Trump's vision in areas of Gaza no longer controlled by the militants, U.S. officials said. But the pitfalls are in plain sight, some analysts and officials said. For starters, Hamas hasn't yet made clear whether it would sign on to the plan. Arab countries are unlikely to send troops if Israel continues striking Hamas targets in Gaza. Israeli forces are unlikely to withdraw from the enclave until all hostages are released, up to 20 of the remaining 48 are thought to still be alive. But Israel and the U.S. have insisted that Hamas must release all hostages for the plan to be implemented. The interim governing body Trump has proposed, which includes former U.K. Prime Minister Tony Blair as a board member, could struggle to gain legitimacy within the enclave. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia and Egypt want to see a clear path to a two-state solution and for the Palestinian Authority to play a significant governance role in the enclave. Netanyahu ruled out the possibility of the authority having any involvement in a post-war Gaza, however. Without a clear pathway to a two-state solution, Saudi Arabia is unlikely to fund the planned, Arab officials said. Officials from several Arab countries, including Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, took part in related meetings on the sidelines of the Trump-Netanyahu summit on Monday, Arab officials said. Netanyahu has said there will never be a Palestinian state, though the U.S. plan leaves open the possibility of a sovereign, independent state, officials said. Trump's also said he would prevent Israel from annexing the West Bank, a move U.S. and some Israeli officials assert would harm prospects of a two-state solution and complicate efforts to expand the Abraham Accords, which normalize relations between Israel and Arab countries. Hamas has opposed disarming or destroying its weapons as laid out in the text. The group also said it will be difficult to release all the hostages within 48 hours as it has lost contact with some of the groups holding them for weeks, Arab officials said. That's Trump outlines plan to end Gaza war, threatens Hamas. Our next article is by Benjamin Katz and Drew Fitzgerald. Boeing launches work on 737 MAX successor. A new narrow-body aircraft is in early development after a series of crises. Boeing is quietly planning a new single-aisle airplane that would succeed the 737 MAX, according to people familiar with the matter, a long-term bid to recover business loss to rival Airbus during its series of safety and quality problems. Earlier this year, Chief Executive Kelly Ortberg met officials from Rolls-Royce Holdings in the UK, two of the people said, where they discussed a new engine for the aircraft. Ortberg appointed a new senior product chief in its commercial plane business, whose prior role was developing a new type of aircraft. Boeing has also been designing the flight deck of a new narrow-body aircraft, according to a person familiar with the plans. This aircraft is in early-stage development, and plans are still taking shape, some of the people said. Boeing's plans represent a shift for the company, which had put some new aircraft development work on the back burner while it navigated multiple challenges. They're also a sign that the company is betting that a cutting-edge plane design could power its business for the next few decades. Ortberg hasn't publicly detailed any plans for a 737 successor. He's consistently said that fixing Boeing's long-running quality and manufacturing problems and shoring up its balance sheet are his priorities. At a recent investor conference, Ortberg said the company is looking to finish up various projects, which will also free up a lot of capital for us to focus on what's next. Boeing said that it remains focused on its recovery plan, including delivering on a backlog of about 6,000 commercial airplanes and certifying already announced aircraft models. Our team evaluates the market, advances key technologies, and improves our financial performance so that we'll be ready when the time is right to move forward with a new product, the company said. Boeing's aircraft development programs have struggled in recent years. The 737 MAX entered commercial service in May 2017. Two deadly crashes resulted in a global grounding of the fleet in 2019 and delayed two new variants. The company later dropped plans to build a new mid-sized aircraft it had been trumpeting. It is years behind on a new upgrade for its 777. The crashes and other safety problems dented customers' confidence, spurred turnover in Boeing's senior management, and prompted regulatory crackdowns. Rival Airbus didn't sit still. The European aircraft manufacturer has grown to be the world's biggest by total deliveries and order backlog. Despite starting production about 20 years after its rival, Airbus deliveries of A320 narrow-body jets have caught up to Boeing's deliveries of its 737s. Airbus's gains are bringing it billions of dollars to invest in its own next-generation narrow-body, an aircraft that it wants to deliver to customers in the late 2030s. Boeing's previous chief, Dave Calhoun, considered reviving the effort for a mid-sized aircraft and discussed the idea with customers. Those plans took a backseat to more pressing problems following a mid-air door plug blowout that exposed manufacturing problems and led to his ouster in 2024. Boeing has historically signaled development plans years in advance to entice customers, lock in suppliers, and drum up interest from investors. Ortberg, who's led Boeing for just over a year, has had an eye on its next big play. Building an all-new aircraft can take over a decade and cost tens of billions of dollars. Manufacturers typically look for at least a 15% jump in fuel efficiency when deciding whether to embark on a major plane program. That could come from a new engine, architecture, lighter materials, or radical changes to the airframe. In February, Ortberg traveled to Rolls-Royce's factory in Derby, England, where he met with the company's CEO, Tufan Erginbilgic. The Boeing chief heard the company's pitch to supply an engine for a new narrow-body aircraft. "We actually hosted Boeing leadership in Derby to talk about narrow-body this year," Erginbilgic said, according to a transcript of a September investor event viewed by the Wall Street Journal. That should give you a sense of where conversations are. Rolls-Royce, which began testing a prototype of its newest engine in 2023, doesn't yet have a customer for the technology. The new engine could offer a 10% jump in fuel efficiency compared with engines on Airbus's A320neo and up to 20% when combined with other upgrades to a new airframe, the Rolls-Royce CEO said at the investor presentation. In a separate media event, Erginbilgic said the company would need a partner to help manufacture the engines and could begin deliveries as soon as 2035, a faster timeline than Airbus is planning for its next narrow-body plane. A Rolls-Royce deal would mark a major change for Boeing, which for about 40 years has used engines from CFM International, a joint venture between GE Aerospace and Safran, to power its 737 narrow-body planes. The first 737 made its debut in the 1960s. In April, Boeing shifted the focus of a project with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration aimed at developing a radical new and greener aircraft known as X-66. Instead, the company has retooled that effort to design a lighter and more aerodynamic wing for a new aircraft. The next month, Ortberg promoted Brian Yutko, boss of its flying taxi subsidiary Wisk Aero, to a role leading product development within the company's commercial division. The role would include overseeing any successor to the 737 family of planes. Boeing executives have said that Wisk Technologies would be essential to designing future cockpit avionics, including Boeing's next airplane. Ortberg has worked to convince customers and the public that Boeing can overcome its challenges. "Boeing is doing a really good job at the moment. The aircraft are coming out early. Quality is excellent," Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary said in August. And that's Boeing launches work on 737 MAX successor. Our next article is OpenAI video to test copyright guardrails. This is by Keech Hagee, Berger Jin, and Ben Fritz. OpenAI is planning to release a new version of its Sora video generator that creates videos featuring copyright material unless copyright holders opt out of having their work appear, according to people familiar with the matter. OpenAI began alerting talent agencies and studios about the forthcoming product and its opt-out process over the last week and plans to release the new version in the coming days, the people said. The opt-out process for the new version of Sora means that movie studios and other intellectual property owners would have to explicitly ask OpenAI not to include their copyright material in videos the tool creates. "The policy is emblematic of AI companies' aggressive stance on the content that underpins and is created by their fast-growing tools as they race to attract new users. It is part of a broader shift that new AI tools have heralded in the control that copyright owners wield over their work. While copyright characters will require an opt-out, the new product won't generate images of recognizable public figures without their permission," people familiar with OpenAI's thinking said. "Our general approach has been to treat likeness and copyright distinctly," said Jason Kwan, Chief Strategy Officer of OpenAI. People familiar with the company's policy said any new video generator would have similar copyright guardrails to ChatGPT's image generator tool, which was released in April. It promptly flooded the internet with memes in the style of the Japanese animation studio, Studio Ghibli. OpenAI has agreements with some studios to keep its tools from surfacing their copyrighted characters upon their request, according to some of the people. The Wall Street Journal's parent company, News Corp, has a content deal with OpenAI. OpenAI and its rivals are competing fiercely for users as they launch new AI-powered tools that could transform entertainment and social media. One of OpenAI's most formidable competitors is Alphabet-owned Google, which recently connected its VO3 AI video generator to its popular YouTube platform, allowing users to incorporate the technology in short-form videos. Given the intense competition in the space, they think maybe we'll ask for forgiveness instead of asking for permission, said Chris D'Elia Garcia, a communications, entertainment, and media professor at Georgetown Law School. OpenAI doesn't plan to accept a blanket opt-out across all of an artist's studio or studio's work, the people familiar with the new Sora tool said. Instead, it sent some talent agencies a link to report violations that they or their clients discover. If there are folks that do not want to be part of this ecosystem, we can work with them, Varun Shetty, VP of Media Partnerships at OpenAI, said of guardrails that the company built into its image generation tool. OpenAI released the initial version of Sora last December, allowing users to create high-definition video clips from text prompts. For so many in the AI space, this move validates long-standing fears and underscores why we need guardrails, said Dan Neely, CEO of Vermilio, an AI licensing and protection platform. The new version of Sora comes at a delicate political moment for OpenAI. The company is awaiting assurance from the Attorneys General of California and Delaware that they won't oppose its attempt to convert to a structure closer to a traditional for-profit company. OpenAI has told some investors that if the conversion isn't completed by the end of the year, they can claw back some of their promised investment, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Hollywood's relationship with many AI companies has been fraught. Creative talent has pushed for AI companies to seek consent and offer compensation when their work is used to train models and when those tools spit out content based on creative works. This spring, OpenAI and Google publicly lobbied the Trump administration to declare that using copyright material to train AI models was fair use under copyright law. The request prompted backlash from Hollywood talent, with more than 400 actors, directors, musicians, and other creative professionals signing an open letter arguing that U.S. dominance in AI shouldn't come at the expense of its creative industries. Trump, a Republican, said this summer that while AI systems can't copy or plagiarize an article, if you read an article and learn from it, we have to allow AI to use that pool of knowledge without going through the complexity of contract negotiations. This summer, judges sided with Meta Platforms and Anthropic in parts of two cases, finding that using copyright material to train AI models was fair use when the material was transformed into something meaningfully different. That's OpenAI video to test copyright guardrails. Our next article is by Scott Patterson and Tarini Party. FEMA revamp paralyzes recoveries. Plan to shift responsibilities to states delays federal disaster funds. St. Louis. Minutes after a mile-wide tornado struck this city on an otherwise beautiful day this spring, Ollie Rand heard her husband shout as he surveyed the devastation surrounding their Tony neighborhood of historical homes. "Everything is gone," Rand, 38, remembers him saying. The tornado, packing winds of 152 miles an hour, hit the city with blunt force, killing five people. In the weeks following the storm, Rand and other private citizens mobilized teams of residents whose neighborhoods had been destroyed to clean up debris, remove fallen trees, and rebuild shattered homes. Largely missing from the recovery efforts, according to Rand, city officials and other residents, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. "I've never seen someone from FEMA out on the streets," Rand said. "That is by design. St. Louis is a test case for the Trump administration's new policy of shifting more responsibility for natural disasters to states and cities. City officials and local residents who are still clearing rubble from destroyed buildings 4 months after the tornado said the experiment isn't going well. Many of FEMA's core functions related to preparing for natural disasters and leading recovery efforts after they strike have ground to a halt as the Trump administration redefines the agency, according to more than a dozen FEMA employees and local officials, as well as a review of internal government documents. Crucial contracts and grants haven't been approved, caught up in layers of new bureaucracy. A wave of senior staff departed the agency when Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency offered buyouts, taking decades of experience with them. Around 400 FEMA employees have been detailed to work at U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement as that agency rapidly expands. And the administration has started dismantling the agency's disaster response infrastructure, which was strengthened after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The scaled-back federal response has left places like St. Louis in a bind. The city doesn't have the finances, institutional knowledge, or equipment to rapidly respond to catastrophes like the tornado that struck in May, which the city estimates caused $1.6 billion in damage. St. Louis Mayor Kara Spencer, a Democrat who'd been in office for just a month when the tornado hit, pointed in an interview to the rapid federal response to a tornado that struck Joplin, Missouri in 2011. "That didn't happen here," she said. "We're running the response ourselves." As a result, entire streets remained lined by shattered houses and heaps of the city's famous red bricks and torn-up trees. Much of the damage occurred in the majority black northern sections of St. Louis. It took the White House 2 weeks to approve a disaster declaration in early June, a move that typically unleashes a gusher of cash and on-the-ground assistance. But city officials said they're still waiting for most of that aid. FEMA officials arrived to go door-to-door to help residents apply for federal funds, but they stopped providing the service as the administration canceled the program nationwide, according to a city official. FEMA closed disaster recovery facilities where residents could apply for financial assistance last week. Tricia McLaughlin, spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security, which has housed FEMA since 2003, said the agency moved quickly to support Missouri and St. Louis in the aftermath of the May tornado. She denied that FEMA preemptively pulled back door-to-door teams in St. Louis. "The city has run into a problem that's plaguing the entire agency's operation. A requirement that all spending of $100,000 or more go through a Byzantine process for approval that involves up to a dozen layers of review. The process instituted by DHS Secretary Kristi Noem is breaking down the agency's ability to respond to disasters at every level, according to several FEMA employees and the review of documents. The process has had no negative impact to providing assistance in Missouri," said McLaughlin. "DHS is rooting out rampant fraud and abuse," she said. "Claims that core disaster response operations are unfunded are simply false. As of early September, roughly 1,000 contracts and grants were pending approval, many of which are central to disaster response," the documents show. Employees said they are spending the bulk of their work hours trying to get spending approved and coming up with contingency plans for programs that have been denied funding. For St. Louis, a major part of its requested federal assistance involves disposing of the estimated 1 million tons of debris that lined city streets and yards, which the city estimated would cost more than $700 million. Its request to FEMA to help cover those costs remained in limbo until mid-September, when the city said FEMA had agreed to cover 75% of eligible debris removal costs. Private citizens such as Rand have stepped in to fill the gaps. To President Trump and other White House officials, that's a new and improved model. Trump has called for FEMA to be eliminated or drastically downsized, arguing that the agency has failed to adequately respond to disasters. State and private sector are better equipped to perform FEMA's mission, he said. In January, Trump said FEMA was very bureaucratic and it's very slow, adding that the agency's disaster response costs a tremendous amount of money. DHS requested a $36.2 billion budget for the agency for fiscal year 2026, up $3.9 billion from the previous year. Under Trump's plan to downsize FEMA, federal funds would be granted to states for them to manage recoveries, although details of how things would operate or whether the budget would shrink haven't been made clear. President Trump is committed to right-sizing the federal government while empowering state and local governments, said Abigail Jackson, spokeswoman for the White House. Pencil and paper. The bottleneck in operations created by the new funding approval process has caused deep concerns throughout FEMA about its ability to respond to a major Atlantic hurricane like the two storms, Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton, that hit this time last year. Funding is yet to be fully approved for key contracts, according to documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal that track the spending approval process. That includes a program that handles preliminary disaster assessments, which are congressionally mandated and form the basis of a federal disaster declaration. Funding for software and systems through Oracle that underpin many of FEMA's operations, including databases that are used by victims to apply for assistance, is also held up. Employees have been instructed by senior staff to prepare to operate like FEMA did in the early 1990s when work was handled manually or by using Microsoft Excel spreadsheets with complicated formulas for calculating assistance. Funding requests are also routed through DOGE, which adds another layer of bureaucracy to the process and contributes to delays, according to FEMA employees and state officials. After wildfires spread in Colorado in late August, an email sent to employees directed them to manually fill out forms to prepare for the potential loss of access to a program used for damage assessment. We're recommending that you revert to paper and pencil methods, according to the email, which was reviewed by the journal. As of early September, hundreds more grants and contracts had yet to be approved, including funding for replenishing the agency's supply of boxed drinking water, rent for facilities, storm surge monitoring data, and the updating of flooding maps, including for flood-prone regions such as Kerr County, Texas, where flash floods this summer killed more than 135, including children. Officials are also looking at shutting down entire FEMA offices across the country, according to people familiar with the discussions, as part of the administration's efforts to downsize the agency and shift responsibility to states. NOAA has said that approvals for disaster response would be expedited, but guidelines sent to employees detailing how to write a memo for contract approval state that disaster-related approvals have to be made in less than 20 days, a timeline FEMA employees said was slower than typical, warning the system could add significant delays to projects. During a recent response exercise, which employees do to prepare for a disaster, officials spent the bulk of time figuring out how many spending memos would be needed in the immediate aftermath of a major Atlantic hurricane, according to people familiar with the exercise. Based on the spending level for Hurricanes Helene and Milton, employees determined it would require at least 80 funding approvals by NOAA in the initial days to effectively save lives and assist victims, one of the people said. Trump touted his administration's response to the fast-moving floods that ravaged Kerr County, but inside the agency, employees said NOAA's spending approvals paralyzed FEMA. It took 72 hours for spending to be approved for search and rescue teams on the ground, which concerned Ken Pagurek, the head of FEMA's Urban Search and Rescue Unit, enough to resign, according to people or to employees familiar with his thinking. It also resulted in a delay in helping people affected by the flooding who were reaching out to FEMA's phone line. Data reviewed by the Journal show more than 500 people waiting in the queue in early July. McLaughlin said FEMA experienced no delays in deployment of assets in Texas. She said despite the influx in calls, FEMA's disaster call center responded to every caller swiftly and efficiently, assuring no one was left without assistance. Staff losses. The Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan agency that works for Congress, said in a September report that a high number of reductions across FEMA's workforce, including the loss of experienced disaster management officials, could reduce effectiveness of federal disaster response for upcoming disasters. two dozen senior executive employees at FEMA had left the agency between January 25th and June the 1st, ahead of the hurricane season, according to the report. Agency officials told the GAO that the departures, many of which were part of the DOGE buyout offer, had left FEMA with just 50% of its senior executive service staff. The loss of experienced staff has been exacerbated by the new decision-making process at the agency, which is largely controlled by political appointees, employees said. Top appointees lack experience, and David Richardson, the acting administrator, has largely ceded his authority to DHS, according to people familiar with the agency's operations. Richardson is leading FEMA's response to every declared disaster and is focused on results, not recognition, McLaughlin said. With ICE looking to expand its immigration enforcement operations significantly, DHS is using hundreds of FEMA staffers to help with human resources work and background checks, according to people familiar with the operations. DHS continued to reduce employees even after the official start of the hurricane season in June. The agency put on leave more than 30 FEMA employees who signed a public petition to Congress known as the Katrina Declaration. The petition alleged that FEMA's leadership wasn't following the laws that were put in place in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina to strengthen disaster response. Declan Crow, who was put on leave for signing the letter, grew concerned after seeing the agency's response to the flooding in Texas. He decided to work in emergency management after seeing the effects of Hurricane Sandy in 2012 on his family. He didn't think the agency was living up to its mission under the current administration. There was definitely not enough assistance right after the disaster in Texas, he said. Now, take a bigger hurricane or something like that, and there's a real problem there. In some ways, St. Louis is luckier than other cities and states struck by disasters this year since Trump approved its disaster declaration request in June. As of August 31st, a dozen outstanding disaster requests from across the country were sitting on Trump's desk, nearly double the average on that date from 2016 to 2024, according to Sarah Labowitz, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Trump approved six more in mid-September, but FEMA employees said the process for approving disaster declarations remains slow and opaque. Officials in North Carolina complain that funding from FEMA for recovery from Hurricane Helene remains stuck in the gears of the federal bureaucracy. Senator Ted Budd has moved to put a hold on DHS nominees as a protest against funding delays from FEMA in his home state. And that's FEMA revamp. Paralyzes recoveries. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either at a time of your choosing or as it streams by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or from the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Well, let's turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Electronic Arts in biggest LBO ever. Auto parts supplier first brands files for bankruptcy. And Javis is sentenced to 7 years for fraud. That first headline, Electronic Arts and biggest LBO ever, $55 billion takeover marks push by Saudis into the video game industry. This is by Nicholas G. Miller and Lauren Thomas. Video game maker Electronic Arts said it would go private in a $55 billion deal with a group of investors including Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, private equity firm Silver Lake, and Jared Kushner's investment firm Affinity Partners. The deal represents the largest leverage buyout of all time, eclipsing a record set in 2007. Electronic Arts publishes The Sims, football game Madden NFL, and FIFA, the soccer video game now known as FC. It's been boosted by sales of its marquee sports games and is expected to release Battlefield 6, the latest edition of its popular shooting game. The Wall Street Journal reported last week the video game maker was in advanced talks to be taken private by the three investment firms. The mega deal marks a continued push by Saudi Arabia's PIF into the video game industry. The fund already had a 10% stake in EA, in addition to a minority stake in Nintendo, and has acquired game company Scopely and Niantic's video game division, which makes Pokemon Go. PIF is expected to contribute a majority of the roughly $36 billion equity investment from the investor consortium after rolling over its existing stake, people familiar with the matter said. Technology-focused Silver Lake has also been investing more in game companies. It owns a stake in Unity Software, which makes software for game development and counts EA as a major customer. EA stockholders will receive $210 a share in cash, a 25% premium to EA's share price at Thursday's close, the last day before the journal's report. The parties had been in discussions on and off for months before talks accelerated this month, people familiar with the matter said. Bankers at J.P. Morgan Chase, which is providing $20 billion in debt financing, received a call less than 2 weeks ago to get involved, some of the people said. Goldman Sachs, which is representing Electronic Arts on the deal, has a long-standing relationship with the company. Video game makers have been contracting after a pandemic boom. EA shares had significantly underperformed the S&P 500 during the last 5 years. EA is led by Chief Executive Officer Andrew Wilson. The largest leverage buyout to date had been the 2007 purchase of Texas utility TXU by a group of private equity firms for around $32 billion, according to Dealogic. That's Electronic Arts in biggest LBO ever. Next, we have auto parts supplier First Brands files for bankruptcy. This is by Alexander Gladstone. First Brands Group filed for bankruptcy Monday, threatening big losses for Wall Street lenders after the market lost confidence in the auto supplier's financial disclosures and use of off-balance sheet debt. The closely held company's lenders and independent board directors are now probing whether First Brands made misrepresentations in its financial reporting, people familiar with the matter said. The bankruptcy filing capped a swift unraveling for First Brands that has riveted Wall Street and fueled concerns that frothy markets are concealing underlying weakness in corporate borrowers and insufficiently compensating investors for risk. Wall Street Journal Pro Bankruptcy reported last week that First Brands, a company behind products such as Fram oil filters and Anko windshield wipers, was preparing for Chapter 11 after prices on its corporate loans cratered in recent weeks. First Brands relied heavily on accounts receivable-backed financing, supplying automotive products to customers on delayed payment terms, and borrowing from outside investors against the billed receivables. Lenders to First Brands have been apprised of indications a company may have substantially more obligations than the underlying accounts receivable, with the discrepancy amounting to nearly $2 billion, according to people familiar with the company. A First Brands representative declined to comment on possible accounting irregularities. Some participants in the company's supply chain financing programs also became aware that certain auto inventory that served as collateral may have been transferred out of their reach, some of the people said. First Brands has brought on independent directors to examine such issues and others stemming from the off-balance sheet arrangements, they said. First Brands listed at least $10 billion in liabilities in its Chapter 11 petition filed in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Houston. A group of senior lenders agreed to provide a $1.1 billion loan to finance the proceedings, the company said in an announcement. With committed funding from our key financial partners, we remain focused on supporting our employees, working with our valued suppliers, and delivering best-in-class aftermarket automotive technology for our customers globally, said Chuck Moore, First Brands' chief restructuring officer. First Brands had been working to refinance its $6 billion of corporate debt until last month when lenders demanded more details about the company's earnings and factoring agreements, a type of supply chain financing in which third-party investors assume payment streams and obligations. Concern heightened when lenders became aware that Apollo Global Management had an earlier bet against First Brands by purchasing credit default swaps on the company's debt. First Brands' loans tanked in value, making one of several troublesome developments for the strained automotive industry. First Brands is advised by Lazard and Weil Gotshal and Manges. A group of First Brands' top lenders is represented by the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher and Evercore. A smaller group of lenders is organized with Glenn, Agri, Bergman and Fuentes in an attempt to participate in the bankruptcy loan, according to people familiar. Rochester, Michigan-based First Brands supplies auto parts like brake components, wiper blades and spark plugs. The company grew rapidly in recent years through a series of brand acquisitions. Alexander Gladstone writes about bankruptcy for Wall Street Journal Pro. And that's auto parts supplier First Brands files for bankruptcy. Next article is by Alexander Saidi. Javis is sentenced to 7 years for fraud. Charlie Javis was sentenced to more than 7 years in prison for defrauding J.P. Morgan Chase when she sold her startup to the megabank for $175 million and provided bogus evidence that her company had millions of customers that didn't actually exist. Prosecutors had recommended she spend 12 years in jail for the fraud, which captured Wall Street's attention for tricking the nation's biggest bank, famed for its deal-making acumen. J.P. Morgan Chase was fraudulently induced to buy Javis's startup, Judge Alvin Hellerstein of the Southern District of New York said before delivering the sentence. The lie was embellished through very clever means. He sentenced her to 85 months in custody and ordered that she be placed under 3 years of supervised release once she leaves prison. Prosecutors have also asked the court to order Javis to pay back around $300 million in restitution and forfeit nearly $20 million she has in frozen accounts. Prosecutors say most of those frozen funds came from J.P. Morgan's purchase of her company in 2021, although they say approximately $9 million she got can't be located. This was an audacious criminal scheme, Assistant U.S. Attorney Micah Ferguson said in court on Monday. J.P. Morgan Chase didn't acquire a company, they acquired a crime scene. On Monday, the judge also ordered that Javis and other executives pay around $288 million in restitution, including some $115 million in legal fees the bank accrued. Hellerstein ruled that Javis will have to pay approximately 10% of her monthly earnings to cover the restitution, which is well in excess of her existing wealth. When Javis launched Frank, a startup focused on helping students get access to financial aid, she was hailed as an up-and-coming female entrepreneur. Months after the sale, J.P. Morgan learned the number of people with Frank accounts was around 300,000, far less than the 4 million users Javis had said it had during the sale process. She was arrested in 2023. The weeks-long trial in Manhattan this spring brought to light embarrassing details about the bank's failed due diligence process. A jury returned a guilty verdict on several counts of fraud in March. Javis maintained her innocence during the whole trial, but acknowledged that she had made mistakes. "At 28, I did something that goes against the grain of my upbringing," Javis said Monday, in tears and clutching a handful of tissues. "Not a day goes by that I do not feel profound remorse. I am deeply sorry, and I'm asking with all my heart for forgiveness." Several of Javis's former business associates and friends wrote to the court to ask the judge for leniency. Mark Rowan, the chief executive of Apollo Global Management and a personal investor in Javis's startup, said she loved to help people who needed help and that her thoughtful commitment to this mission is one of the reasons I decided to invest with her. Javis's attorneys told Hellerstein that J.P. Morgan's failure to conduct proper due diligence should weigh in favor of her receiving a more lenient sentence. Other financial firms, such as Capital One, considered buying Frank, but declined after looking at a sample of the company's user data. Chavez's attorneys say they plan to appeal her conviction and ask that she be granted bail while that process plays out. She'd been ordered to wear an ankle monitor while awaiting sentencing. And that's Chavez is sentenced to 7 years for fraud. Next, we have OpenAI lets users buy via ChatGPT. This is by Bell Lin. OpenAI is getting ChatGPT users to buy things through its popular artificial intelligence chatbot, all without leaving the confines of its platform. The San Francisco AI company said Monday U.S. ChatGPT users will be able to buy goods from online marketplace Etsy's domestic sellers, as well as some merchants on Shopify's platform. The service, called Instant Checkout, currently only supports single-item purchases. OpenAI also unveiled an open-source technical standard for merchants to build integrations with ChatGPT called Agentic Commerce Protocol, which the company hopes will draw more merchants onto its chatbot platform. The protocol allows merchants to make their products shoppable inside ChatGPT. Amazon.com and Walmart, the nation's two largest digital retailers, aren't currently using the protocol, OpenAI said. OpenAI's announcements came as the company continues expanding the capabilities and reach of its flagship chatbot, which ignited the AI boom in late 2022. More than 1 in 10 people who use ChatGPT have some intent or interest in making a purchase, said Michelle Fradin, product lead for commerce in ChatGPT. That makes ChatGPT an ideal place for users to complete purchases, OpenAI said. OpenAI's Operator AI agent, released this year, can buy goods on behalf of users, but requires them to manually enter their payment information at checkout. ChatGPT's instant checkout feature is meant to be easier to use within the chatbot, plus more users are using ChatGPT to search for products than Operator, Fradin said. Merchants pay a small fee on completed purchases through ChatGPT. OpenAI declined to specify the amount of that fee, citing confidentiality agreements with its partners. For tech giants like Amazon and Google, there's a lot at stake as search and e-commerce are radically upended by tools like ChatGPT. People are turning to AI chatbots and services to act as personal shopping assistants or even asking AI agents to do their purchasing for them. As of August, OpenAI counted roughly 700 million people, 9% of the world's population, as weekly users of ChatGPT, up from 500 million in March. Late last year, OpenAI pushed directly into Google's territory with the launch of a search engine for ChatGPT. The company added product recommendations inside ChatGPT in April, making it easier for chatbot users to compare products and services. For online merchants, there is a risk of losing a direct connection to shoppers who might otherwise be visiting their websites. The merchant gets the sale, that's the benefit, but they lose the customer loyalty, said Emily Pfeiffer, a principal analyst focused on commerce at IT research and consulting firm Forrester. A lot of retailers and brands are just very nervous because this is all moving super quickly. But that's a threat OpenAI says won't bear out. ChatGPT serves a very different purpose than a merchant's website, Fradin said. Bell Lin writes for Wall Street Journal Pro's CIO Journal. That's OpenAI lets users buy via ChatGPT. Our next article, private jet maker lands his first customer for a futuristic aircraft without windows. This is by Owen Tucker Smith. Otto Aerospace's new business jet has no traditional passenger windows and a teardrop-shaped cabin. Private jet company Flexjet wants hundreds of them. The company said Monday that Flexjet signed a contract to buy 300 of Otto's Phantom 3500 aircraft. Flexjet's order would be worth approximately $5.85 billion based on market pricing for each jet, though the companies declined to comment on the negotiated value of their deal. Flexjet will be Otto's first fleet customer. The aircraft is in development with its first flight targeted for 2027. Auto's Phantom 3500, which seats 9 passengers, is lined with digital panes that display a virtual view of the outdoors, a feature that Chief Executive Paul Tao calls supernatural vision. Tao said the plane's design helps cut fuel burn by 60% compared with other jets of similar size. That could help make private flights cheaper over time than seats in an airline's business class, he added. The plane's virtual windows are powered by high-resolution cameras fixed to the outside of the aircraft. The lack of windows makes for a lighter aircraft, Otto said, and the smoother exterior allows the plane to be more aerodynamic. The company said the digital displays inside the cabin will be 6 feet wide and provide a color-enhanced panoramic view of what's around the jet. You no longer have to lean over and look out the window, Tao said. You could sit in our seat and look at the entire world around you. It is surreal. The company said the digitized windows will be compelling to customers, especially Gen Z travelers who are more technologically savvy. Ohio-based Flexjet leases and sells fractional ownership of private jets to individuals and Fortune 500 companies. It has been looking to build out its fleet as more wealthy Americans look to fly private. Flexjet is fresh off an $800 million investment led by private equity firm L. Catterton and has catered to a luxury clientele with invite-only Napa Valley wine tastings and philanthropic events. It has a fleet of roughly 340 jets and is valued above $4 billion. Otto has so far raised $250 million from private investors and is building the Phantom 3500 in Jacksonville, Florida, with the help of a $515 million incentive package from the state. Otto is targeting delivery by 2030. The company built its first full-size mock-up of the plane recently for an industry conference. The cabin is 22 feet long and 7.5 feet wide. Otto aims to use revenue from sales of the Phantom jet to build a larger regional aircraft with a similar aerodynamic design, the Otto CEO said. Meanwhile, he's focused on the business jet market, which he valued at $43 billion a year. Everybody's running around all excited about Firefly and SpaceX and Rocket Lab, Tao said. The market for moving wealthy people around the world every day is actually much bigger than the market for moving stuff into space. And as private jet maker lands its first customer for a futuristic aircraft without windows. Our next item is from the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. Debt is fueling next wave of AI boom. For aspiring AI players like Oracle, much rides on leverage and hope. In the initial years of the artificial intelligence boom, comparisons to the dot-com bubble didn't make much sense. 3 years in, growing levels of debt are making them ring a little truer. Early on, wealthy technology companies were opening their wallets to outjoust each other for leadership in artificial intelligence. They were spending cash generated largely from advertising and cloud computing businesses. There was no debt-fueled splurge on computing and networking infrastructure like the one that inflated the bubble 2.5 decades ago. While big tech companies are still at AI's forefront and are in solid financial shape, a crop of more highly leveraged companies is ushering in an era that could change the complexion of the boom. A few smaller companies, most prominently CoreWeave, have been relying on creative financing to vault themselves to the AI forefront for a while. More recently, though, ambitions of companies such as OpenAI are poised to take leverage and mega contracts to a whole new level. OpenAI is laying the groundwork for a network of data centers that will cost at least $1 trillion over the next few years. As part of its push, the company signed a $300 billion five-year contract this month under which Oracle is to set up AI computing infrastructure and lease it to OpenAI. To make good on its end of the contract, Oracle has to spend on that infrastructure before it gets paid in full by OpenAI, which means a lot of borrowing. Analysts at KeyBank Capital Markets estimated in a recent note that Oracle would have to borrow $25 billion a year over the next 4 years. And Oracle is highly leveraged. The company had long-term debt of about $82 billion at the end of August, and its debt-to-equity ratio was about 450%, By contrast, Google parent Alphabet's ratio was 11.5% in its latest quarter, and Microsoft's was about 33%. Oracle and other less well-heeled AI aspirants, such as CoreWeave, have few options other than to borrow if they want to play in the big leagues. Nebius Group, another NASDAQ-listed AI cloud company like CoreWeave, reached a $19.4 billion deal in September to supply Microsoft with AI computing services and said it would fund the required capital spending through a combination of its cash flow and debt secured against the contract. Investors so far haven't been too concerned. Oracle's shares shot up after the company revealed a huge expansion of projected revenue owing to its OpenAI deal, even though it will burn through cash for years to fund it. CoreWeave's shares have more than tripled since the company listed in March, while Nebius rose nearly 50% after news of its Microsoft deal. But there is reason for skepticism about these companies' ability to fulfill their contracts and repay their debts. Numerous recent studies found AI isn't gaining traction as quickly as its backers suggest. Only 3% of consumers are paying for it, according to one study. Projections of spending on AI data centers reaching trillions of dollars a year within the next few years seems highly optimistic. Despite the hype around the company, OpenAI's position looks tenuous. It would need to grow to more than $300 billion of annual revenue in 2030 to justify the spending envisioned in the Oracle contract, D.A. Davidson analyst Gil Luria estimates. A big rise from the company's current run rate of about $12 billion. OpenAI has backing from SoftBank and NVIDIA, which is pledging to invest as much as $100 billion as the build-out proceeds. That's big, but far from sufficient. The vast majority of Oracle's data center capacity is now promised to one customer, OpenAI, who itself does not have the capital to afford its many obligations, Luria said. Oracle might be able to reduce its risk by proceeding with spending only as it recognizes revenue from OpenAI, but Moody's cited significant risks in a note this month, pointing to the enormous cost of buying equipment and securing land and electricity. Whether these will be financed through traditional debt, leases, or highly engineered financing vehicles, the overall growth in balance sheets obligations will be extremely large, it said. Moody's in July gave Oracle's credit rating a negative outlook. There is a decent chance that it all works out. Oracle might manage its contracts and debt adeptly as it's done in the past. CoreWeave, Nebius, and other players might also usher in a wave of financial innovation that spurs AI growth. But it's at least equally likely that many of today's massive contracts get postponed or renegotiated because end demand for AI services doesn't grow in line with the infrastructure build-out. That's all the time we have for that article by Asa Fitch, Debt is Fueling Next Wave of AI Boom. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal. And remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either at a time of your choosing or as it streams by going to sunsounds.org, the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, or downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams on your Amazon Dot or Echo.